Welcome to the CCFR Radio Podcast, your source for news, updates, and stories from the CCFR.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 85 of the CCFR Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Rod Giltaka. Thanks for joining me again. Today on the podcast, it is a really important podcast, probably one of the most important in the last few months. So we've got a lot of stuff to cover. So I got a list, keep me on track, and I'm going to try to get through everything as quickly as possible. So on the show, I've got a couple of housekeeping items really quick in the beginning. Then I'm going to bring on Tracy Wilson, who's going to help me go through a lot of important stuff. There's buybacks out. There's a lot of farm-related media. There's new legislation due to be tabled on Tuesday. It's on the order paper right now. Tracy is going to come on and help me go through a bunch of that stuff. And then I've got a couple of items to talk to you before. Oh, yeah. And there's so much going on. I'm having a hard time keeping it straight to even tell you about it. I'm also going to have General Counsel, CCFR General Counsel, Mike Loberg on the show, a rare treat. And he's going to talk about just what happened from a legal perspective. Or if you haven't heard, I got bad news for you. Our injunction application was unsuccessful. And you know what? We knew that it was a 90% chance we weren't going to win anyway. But still, I mean, you know, it's always nice to win. So he's going to tell us about what happened, the reasons that talk about the ruling a little bit as much as he can, because there's an ongoing legal action. And what does this mean for our case? And basically, what's next for the CCFR versus Canada? So housekeeping items real quick. Let me look on my list. First thing, I did an interview this morning on the Mike Smith show, which is on CKNW and it's talk radio in Vancouver. And opposite was Najma Ahmed from the Canadian Doctors for Protection from Guns. And what a mess. We're going to get that interview up as soon as possible so that all of you can hear it, because it just happened this morning. But she just demonstrated that she doesn't have a clue about firearms. She doesn't have a clue about firearm policy. She doesn't know what laws exist, what laws don't. It's just a real mess. And, you know, we've reached out so many times, like countless times, to say, you know what? We don't have to be enemies. Let's just sit down together and have a normal conversation. And what we get from them are smears and put downs and, oh, screen cap all your tweets and look what you said and you're attacking. Like, we get just all this garbage while they accuse us of smearing them. So it's such a mess. But anyway, I highly encourage you to listen to that interview. It was interesting. There's, unfortunately, she told so much misinformation, so many things that were not true, just false claims. And of course, staying on message with everything's assault weapons, military style, this, that, killing machines. She did all the predictable things, which of course, you know, public safety is not a joke, but you know, when you're talking about taking firearms away from millions of people, it's more than just a few talking points or taglines, on media. There's more to it than that. And it's really important. These are important things. They're not a joke. So anyway, check that out. And now people have been reaching out to me a lot recently. I think Mike Loberg, I posted something on a firearm forum and around on social media, and Mike Loberg was looking for questions to ask Wendy Sukier, because we're going to cross-examine her as part of our case, Canada versus CCFR versus Canada. And people started sending information to me. And in addition to that, people contact me all the time, and they're, you know, people leave me messages. And I'm talking, for a while, it was like anywhere from 30, 40 to 60 a day, right? And I'm just a normal person. I can't respond to them all. I've said this before in the podcast. I just want people to know that it's not that I'm ignoring you or I don't want to talk to you or, you know, it's not that. It's just because I have so much work to do and I'm only one person. And then after I work my 10 hours or whatever it is and my, you know, 6 to 8 hours on Saturday, the rest of the time I got to deal with things in my life, right? Like normal people do. And I have to be a husband and a father at some level too, right? So it's really difficult. So just to let you know, I'm not ignoring you, but it's funny because I get people saying, call me. I have a great idea for the fight. And I'm like, I get it, you know, but I can't call you. I got to pay attention to my family at some point and do all my normal things I got to do that everybody else has to do, like clean your house and, you know, repair the roof if it's leaking and all the rest of that stuff, right? There's a lot of stuff that you have to do in life just to, you know, administrate your life. It's terrible. If I was a real celebrity and I was truly important, then I'd have somebody doing those things for me. But unfortunately, I'm just a gun owner with a video camera. So what I wanted to tell you about this is if you have an idea and you think it's a great idea or whatever, don't contact me or the CCFR and say, I want Rod to call me back. I just don't have time. Do what I'm going to tell you how we do it inside the CCFR. So if there's board of directors members or field officers or me, what we do is if we have an idea for a project, right? So the march was a project, the integrity tour is a project, you know, newspaper ads are a project, the lawsuit's a project. If we're going to do a project, what we do is we do an outline, an essay, like one or two pages. That's all it takes. Just like, here's the idea. Here's what it would take to do it. Here's how many people's required. Here's the costs. Here's the timelines, stuff like that. So it's like, okay, here's your idea. Is this realistic? And so we call everything we do a project. Everything that we do other than the normal stuff. So if we have projects, we always have a project sheet or a little essay on what we're doing so that we can present it to each other or even just among the small group like me and Tracy or just me so that I know, okay, I'm looking at this. I see the reason. Why would we do it? That should be in there, right? What's the net effect? What's the benefit for gun owners? Or is it a fundraising idea? Or is it something like that? Then I can assess whether or not we're going to spend time and money on that kind of stuff. So if you want, if you got ideas out there, don't call and want me to call you and chew the fat about it. Just put your ideas in an essay, in a little project sheet, just a description of the project and send it over and I'll look at it. I see this stuff. I just can't respond to it all. Okay. So anyway, I love the suggestions. I love the help. Just send it in that form and then it's easy for me to look over and see if that's going to work or not. Okay. That's all I'm asking. All right. Okay. That's it. I'm going to bring on Tracy Wilson and we'll cover the rest of this stuff right after this.
Fighting government and those who want less rights for Canadians takes energy and you need to fund it. For a limited time only, you can enjoy some of the best coffee you ever had and support the CCFR at the same time. Introducing Downrange Dark and Select Fire Smoked. Two outstanding coffee selections roasted just for the CCFR. This is dark roast coffee, so be ready for that. And the smoked version is even a little more aggressive. Find it at the CCFR online store at firearmrights.ca and add it to your order. Again, this is only for a limited time, so give it a try and let us know what you think of it. Go to firearmrights.ca and click store. Enjoy the coffee, and thanks for your support of the CCFR.
All right, we're back. And on the Skype, I have Tracy Wilson. How's it going, Tracy?
Oh, hi, Rod.
Hi, Rod.
Oh. It's fine. Oh. Yeah. No, it's going. It's just extremely busy. There's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. So we might as well get into it. I've got my little list here. First thing we should talk about is there's some new legislation on the order paper released or introduced, I should say, on Tuesday.
Correct. So Bill Blair has provided notice on the order paper for Tuesday. So we should expect to see some sort of legislation tabled on Tuesday. You know, hints of what this really looks like. I mean, there's lots of conspiracy theories out there. Nobody really knows until we actually get our hands on it. It will have something to do with the buyback program associated with the OIC gun ban. There's some talk about some change to storage regulations. You know, there's a lot of gun talk going on right now about handgun bans and semi-auto bans, and we don't really know, but here's the good news. We are going to find out together, and we are going to, you know, we'll debrief after we see it. We'll relay that information to our community, and we're going to react in every possible way, you know, that there is. I have been in contact with opposition MPs already all day today. Everybody is on this. Lists are already forming for, you know, witness lists. There's a lot already going on before anybody even sees it. So although We don't know 100% what's going to be in it. It's not like we're, you know, sitting around with, on our hands here. It's all hands on deck. So.
Yeah. So there's a few saving grace items here. First thing is that once legislation is introduced, what happens is it's part of the process. But if there's an election, every existing bill that's on the table dies on the order paper, and then that process has to start over again after an election. I think that's how it works. So
that's exactly right. So once the writ is dropped for an election, everything that's on the table gets dropped. Of course, it can be reintroduced after the election, but that starts the process back over again. So in all reality, there's a lot of talk about, you know, either a late spring, early summer election, maybe June, sometime in there. I think that's highly probable. There is zero chance that any legislation, regardless of what it looks like, would actually be able to go through the entire process with the House of Commons, the three votes, and then onwards to Senate through committee there. There's zero chance that it would pass in 2 to 6 months. So I don't know, but it doesn't mean that we can just, you know, not worry about it. We absolutely have to react to it. And there's a lot of conversation happening due to the, there was a young girl shot in Montreal, which of course launched the Montreal mayor into, you know, a failure to be able to crack down on gang violence, of course, has prompted her to decide that she's once again going to call for a national handgun ban. And then there was a young lady, a 14-year-old girl in Toronto, who was shot in the head in her apartment last night. She is expected to survive. There's not a lot of details on that yet. The original reports from CBC talked about four males running from the scene. But it might have actually been something else going on inside the apartment, like a negligent discharge. Anyways, we're not going to speculate. We'll see what happens. But of course, every time there's conversation and things happen and these tragedies happen, it's like fuel for the anti-gunners to use all of those tragedies as a way to prop up their bad policy ideas to target legal gun owners. And Lord knows that Justin Trudeau, failing miserably on the vaccine portfolio and other files, it's a great opportunity for a channel changer. And we always seem to be the victim of that.
Yeah, so. We always are. And the vaccine failure isn't even just a failure. Like we're at the end of the list. Like there's third world countries that are in better shape than we are. And, you know, the vaccine issue aside, you know, if you remember, I think Bill C-71, when that was introduced, Trudeau, it was the SNC-Lavalin scandal and other things that they always choose to talk about guns when there's a big scandal going on. But,
Well, because we any talk of guns or anything like that, of course, erupts into this massive opposition. There's tons of media on it. Everybody starts talking about that instead of talking about Justin Trudeau's failures. And you're right. The SNC-Lavalin scandal sparked the introduction of C-71, which did pass after 14 months of opposition and received royal assent. However, the measures within it were never even implemented. So if it was so vital to public safety, you know, there hasn't been a sense of urgency to implement that. Not that I'm calling for it, because I'm definitely not, but I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy of calling for these measures under the guise of public safety, yet failing to actually do anything about it. So,
yeah,
we're in for a real busy week next week. So you guys can stay tuned to the CCFR and all of our channels, and, you know, whatever we've got will be circulated to our members and supporters immediately.
Yeah, I asked Mike when I had him on the, I had to do Zoom with him because we couldn't get Skype working, which is unfortunate because the Skype, like maybe not everybody knows, but you're on Skype with me right now. I'm looking at your picture and the Skype integrated, the software that I'm using, despite I have to, you know, fight with the audio portion of it. And sometimes it's a little finicky, but the Skype image is unbelievable. Like it's so clear. It's so excellent quality. So, anyway, all that to say, I asked Mike if he would, participate in a podcast just to give his early impressions of the legislation on Tuesday. And he said that he would make time for that. So I'm not making a promise that I'm going to have him on but we're going to try. But I think between the two of us, we'll look through the legislation. We'll figure out what it means for us. And I'm hoping to have a podcast up on Tuesday, just so everybody knows.
Yeah, that's great. We have to react quickly. And I mean, you have to read it and digest it and understand what it means and how it affects everything else going on right now. The gun ban itself was done through OIC. Any financial matters require legislation, which is part of the reason for that. But we'll also all be watching to see if there's any sneaky things put in there that could, you know, negatively affect our court challenge or have it dismissed, or, you know, there's all kinds of considerations.
All kinds of shenanigans they can be involved with. All right, let's move on. And we'll have to have a quick chat about our Facebook policies, our social media policies, because as you well know, and I think as most people know, social media platforms, at the behest of the Prime Minister of Canada, as well, and his his Heritage Minister with a criminal record that is now his censor czar, right? But anyway, the social media companies have been all over. People that own guns, people that don't vote for the Liberals, people that have opinions that differ from anybody else, and they're deleting entire groups, they're shutting down pages, they are putting limitations on the reach of people that have very popular groups. Like right now, I think we have 52,000 people in our closed CCFR Facebook group, and it's really in danger of being shut down. So, you know, a lot of people are like,
we've seen a couple.
Yeah, my free speech. It's just like, you know what? In our group, we have to be really careful. So go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, we've seen a couple of big groups recently be removed from Facebook. And I think you're totally right. I think sort of these right-wing type groups or speakers or personalities, you see that canceling all over the place. And I know sometimes when something gets deleted in our group, sometimes it hurts somebody's feelings, or maybe they posted something and then the comments just got so sloppy and so out of control that for the admins who are volunteers, you know, nobody's getting paid to sit there and police the social media accounts. Sometimes it's easier just to kind of delete the post and maybe have somebody repost it than it is to try and clean it up. And that triggers people to feel upset because, you know, their post got deleted or their comments got deleted. You know, and normally we try our best to have a really balanced approach to that. But I think for the next little while, the default will be, if it's questionable at all, it's going to go. And there's a couple reasons for that. Number one, we're in a federal court challenge where things that are said and presented on our social media platforms could come into consideration for that. Number two, the anti-gun groups are absolutely in our group and on our pages. Screenshotting what people say, they're using them. You can go over to the Doc's Twitter account, or I think it was Polly Sousouvier, and they're sharing captions of commentary in our group. And, you know, these are the type of people that are in the CCFR. And of course they look for that one guy who's got a little over emotional and said something out of line. So the default for the next little while is going to be, if it's questionable at all, if you know, now's not the time to really have a big long debate about it. We're gonna have to act first and see how things fare out in the long run. But yeah, for now we really have to keep our social media clean. And I mean, you're entitled to your opinions. It's sometimes just in the presentation, right? In the messaging. So
yeah. Well, it's just we don't want to lose our group. It's we put a lot of effort into that group. We don't deserve to lose our group. So we just got to be careful right now. And who knows, maybe there will be an election and people can, you know, live free again. Who knows? That's my pie. Imagine. In the sky, you know, ideas like, oh, someday we may be free, you know, shake these chains of bondage. But, all right. So yeah, I think it's just a good reminder to people, you know, and if you get your stuff deleted in our group, you know, your comment or whatever, just give us a break on it. All right. So
yeah, Matt, just
yeah. Cause we've got a lot of stuff to do. And then I will, you know what? I want to say something else that's important is the people, the team of admins, the people that admin our group do a really good job, and it's all volunteer, and the time commitment and the intellectual commitment to like read all this stuff, and then people are reporting stuff. I don't go and make a judgment call. And they, and you know what? A lot of, I think almost every comment that gets deleted actually gets debated in the admin group. Like they don't just one person just deletes it. Like they put time into it and they do that work for free. So anything that makes their lives a little bit easier, I think makes sense to me. And I just want to tell our admins how much I appreciate their work, because it is important work that has to be done. And I just really appreciate it.
Yeah. And our group, like I'm in quite a few, you know, gun groups and military spouse groups and all kinds of groups on Facebook. And I got to tell you, I have never seen a group as active and busy as ours. Like it's just, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of posts a day. So it is an enormous, like, all-encompassing job for the admins, and I'm really grateful for them. I know I couldn't do it because I just would be annoyed and deleting everything. So nobody wants that either, right?
That's why your admin privileges were revoked.
My admin privileges were revoked, which is hilarious because I work here. But they were. I'm not objective enough. A lot of times I'm just like, that's garbage or useless.
Extremely funny for a lot of reasons.
It is.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to move on. All right. One more thing was that as you guys know, the CCFR launched our club insurance project, you know, for reals after 5 years. And we really need to fund all of the things that we're doing. I actually have a few big tricks up my sleeve that I want to pull those cards out. But I need to fund those things, just like we got to fund our course or our case right now. And one of the ways that we can do that is we can create recurring funding if ranges bring their insurance over to the CCFR, and we'll use that money to throw everything we can, the pots and pans, everything at the government, and fight them tooth and nail to keep our guns. And so anyway, all that to say, there was a video that floated around. We've got a lot of calls, which is great. But a lot of ranges are under the impression that whoever's providing their insurance right now is telling them that they have to have certified range safety officers, either as a condition of getting insurance or a condition of having their range approved with the CFO. And I asked you to have a look at that. And what did you find out?
Yeah, so that was actually a big job. People were calling me, you know, executives from ranges saying that they were beholden to their provider that they're with now because they didn't want to lose their range safety officer certification. Now I know you can get a lot of different firearms training from a lot of different sources. And I started thinking about it, and I've been through the regulations through the Firearms Act, and I got a hold of every provincial CFO across the country. And then of course the national phone number as well. And I even spoke to the Canadian Firearms Program themselves, looking if anybody could tell me or point to me where it is somehow a mandatory requirement that there's some certified program that they either endorse or accept or vouch for, and there is not. So there is a requirement to have an RSO, but there's no endorsed training that provides that. So like, for instance, at my range, basically everybody's an RSO. When I go with a group of friends, we decide, okay, Jim, you're the RSO. We follow the range rules. We, you know, follow everything. You just need that one person to sort of be in charge, right? That's all that's required. So having a range safety officer program or a course is not a terrible idea. It's great. There's nothing wrong with a little extra training. However, nobody's requiring it. And when somebody says, you know, well, we could pull your certification, they just mean literally off their desk because it doesn't actually go anywhere. It doesn't be submitted to the CFO. It isn't submitted to the Canadian Firearms Program. It's a document that you print off your computer. So I'm not trying to dismiss the value of an RSO program. The CCFR is also in the process of developing such a program. I think it's good training to have, but you're not beholden to the provider of that in order to have your range insured. And I've also spoken to the insurance company, and it is not a requirement of any insurance to have some sort of Like, there's no governing body that recognizes anybody's RSO program. So that's basically how I can sum it up the best way.
Yeah. At the end of the day, here's the answer. It's not required. So now now in Quebec, it is required, but it's an organization that I think delivers this Canadian Firearm Safety Course as well, or something like that. So Quebec is
The Fédération de Tir de Québec, and they sort of have the monopoly on courses. You know, even then there's still some debate about if it's required or not, but no other course is recognized in Quebec other than the course through the Fédération de Tir. So Quebec's always a little bit of an anomaly, but yeah, there is no governing body that recognizes anybody's RSO program or certification.
So in other words, at your range, like at the range that I was a member of for a long time, we had 2,500 members and we did not have full-time RSOs nor an RSO certification program. Everybody's an RSO like it was at your range, is at your range.
Right.
And at the end of the day, in most shooting clubs across Canada, you have people that are more than qualified to teach an RSO course. And you can do that yourself. The ranges always had the ability to just do that themselves. So anyway, I don't want to beat it to death because I think a lot of people at ranges are in different positions where they're like, that's uncomfortable information. But apparently that's the truth. So
anyway. Yeah. And if anybody, you know, has any information that's different to that, I'd love for you to send it to me at clubs@firearmrights.ca. But I have spent 2 weeks working on this. I've actually deployed my staff on this as well. Adam's been working on it with me. And we have literally combed the country. It's not recognized by any governing body. So it's not a bad idea. Like I said, I mean, I like taking courses too and improving my skills and my knowledge, but it's not a requirement, nor does anybody recognize it. So.
All right. Well, that's our list. And I've got to get Michael on. So we're going to have to wind it up. Come Tuesday, there's going to be a lot to talk about. So.
Yes. So stay tuned. It's only a couple days away. Try and enjoy some time on family day with your family. Maybe get out to the range if you can or out to the bush. But in the meantime, just stay tuned. Tuesday, we'll have a lot more info.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, Tracy.
Thanks, Rod.
Okay, well, we had to switch over to Zoom because we couldn't get Skype working. But on the Zoom, I have Mike Loberg, who is the general counsel for the CCFR. How's it going, Mike?
Very good, Rod. Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be back.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to fool around with the podcast. But I think it's an important opportunity to update everybody and on what we've done with the injunction application and whatnot, and just get your take on it, because people want to hear from you probably more than they want to hear from me. So,
well, I doubt that's true, but I'm happy to do what I can, Rod.
So eloquent, right? Nice deflection. All right. So I realize that you can't say everything and give all the ins and outs about how we were unsuccessful in our injunction application, because you're still running a case against the government, still in active litigation. But as far as the injunction application, what are the factors that made us unsuccessful?
Well, we have to harken back to the beginning when we started the litigation, and we considered the whole issue of, do we bring an injunction application or do we not? And the underlying ethos of this litigation has always been, we're going to give Canadian firearm owners the best shot at this that we can possibly give. No holds barred. We're going to try everything. And we went to the members and told them clearly, this is a long shot. There's a good chance it's not going to work, because getting an injunction at all is hard. Getting an injunction against legislation that's been passed is significantly difficult. I don't necessarily accept, though, that we went wrong. We went into it with our eyes wide open. We knew what we were going to do. We achieved a lot of our goals, albeit we did not get the injunction that we were seeking. I hate to say it, that was unremarkable. I think the listeners and the members of the CCFR really should focus, among other things, on the fact that we assembled a huge amount of evidence for the injunction, which is going to be used in the main application as well. And nicely, even though we were unsuccessful in the injunction application, we got to take this evidence for a test drive with the government. We saw a couple of areas where we can probably strengthen it up, not that that was determinative, just to be clear. We brought the best case that could be brought with the best lawyers that money can buy. And that evidence was actually very strong. But the test for an injunction is exceptionally high. So we didn't meet that test. We got to see the government's evidence. We got to test the government's lawyers. And nicely, we also got to test the judge who is our case management judge. You did hit it on the head, though, Rod. There are a great deal of limits to what I can say, both due to the fact that I'm in active litigation against the government in a case that's before the courts presently. That by itself really puts some limits on what I can say, as well as, obviously, I don't want to be putting strategic considerations on the table for the Crown Counsel, who may very well be listening to this. I know if Crown Counsel did a podcast about this case, I'd be listening to what they said. Hello, Crown.
Don't forget our friends over at CSIS.
Yes, right? Of course, them as well.
They definitely have to keep an eye on us, the licensed gun owners.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So talking about the injunction, let's just jump right into that. We assembled a huge amount of evidence, and it was very good evidence. And then we went in. But let's remember what the test is. It's a three-part test. There needs to be the existence of a serious issue. Nobody denied that. Even the courts and the opposing parties accepted that, you know, we have a legitimate case that we're bringing here. And then we got the other two parts, which kind of go together. It's the possibility of irreparable harm. Sorry, strike that. Absolute proof of unavoidable irreparable harm. And then the balance of convenience is, if there is irreparable harm, who are we going to foist it upon? Is it going to be foisted upon the government or upon the firearm owners? Now, in short, the court found primarily that the things that we were talking about as to the nature of the harm that we would suffer are all things that be compensated for in money. Now, that's what the decision said. That's obviously not what we argued. And there's good case law to support the positions that we took. Obviously, we don't agree with the outcome of that decision, but I'm kind of constrained as to how I would go about talking about that. Now, the judge found that, as a matter of fact, there is no irreparable harm that can't be compensated for in money. We would take the view, and we did take the view, that being exposed to criminal liability, being deprived of your hunting rights, that sort of, with the firearm of your choice, and also notably with a firearm of your choice, for this is for the First Nations, with the firearms of your choice, where you're not at risk of being put in jail for having used it, because that is also a trap. Just if I can segue off to the Section 35 stuff. If a First Nations individual goes and uses a firearm for hunting under the amnesty, where the amnesty says you can use this firearm until you can buy a replacement that's not prohibited, I mean, that's got to be a trap, because who's to say that you couldn't have bought a firearm that's not prohibited the very next day? Therefore, there's no justification for using your now prohibited firearm. That creates huge liability for First Nations people who are hunting. And that's just one example. Unfortunately, the judge went the other way. Now, we don't agree with that, but there's a couple of things that are true here. Would it make sense to appeal it? You know, I'll put that on the table. The Crown's not going to be surprised. No, we're not going to appeal that. And the simple reason is although it's arguable, it would consume a significant amount of resources. And by the time we got around to actually having that appeal heard, we're going to have our main case heard anyway. So just practically speaking, it doesn't make sense financially or as far as scheduling goes. So no, there's not going to be an appeal of that. And you heard it here first.
Okay. All right. Now, our injunction application was unsuccessful. Is this going to have any negative effect on our case?
None whatsoever. Nicely, there were absolutely no determinations in this injunction decision that is going to impact our main case. There were some indications as to which way the judge thought this case was going to go, which, of course, as I've indicated already, that tends to suggest that there are some things that we may want to try tactically differently when we're at the main hearing, which, just as a note, may or may not be in front of this judge. We may get a different judge for our final hearing. Very often the case management judge will shepherd the case through the preparatory steps of the litigation, get everything set up for the main hearing, and then hand it off to somebody who is absolutely fresh and doesn't have any preconceived notions about the case. So that may very well happen. But in any event, like I said, we've taken our evidence for a test drive, and we've got a judicial opinion, albeit we don't agree with it, but we've got a judicial opinion, so we know at least how one judge views the case that we brought. So now we have knowledge, more knowledge than we had before. If nothing else, it was worth it for that.
Okay. So I guess I think what some people might think is like, was this all just a waste of time? Right. Was this a waste of time and a waste of money? I mean, I don't think so. I think what you've said so far indicates that, you know, we've amassed all of this evidence, and that's evidence that is going to do very well for us in the main case. We've taken our evidence for a test drive. You know, I don't think it was a waste of time. Do you?
Oh, not even remotely. As a matter of fact, stepping aside from this piece of litigation, there's two styles of litigation, which people will see. And if you've had any contact with litigation, you may have seen both styles or one of them. The first style, which I certainly do not agree with, is where you take the necessary steps in the litigation one at a time without a really clear view as to what you're going to do at the end of the litigation. For example, sometimes you see junior lawyers issuing a statement of claim without a clear view as to what is their closing argument going to be when the case is over. That's a massive mistake, in my respectful opinion, for anybody who's doing that. A more expensive but certainly more effective way of doing it is to conduct your investigation as to what facts you can prove, what evidence can you amass. Compare that against the existing case law. Compare that against the current views of the courts and the Canadian public as to whether or not there might be a change in the law that is possible. And then after you've got a clear view as to what it is that you're going to try to achieve at the end of the trial or at the end of the hearing, you can then assemble your case, assemble your evidence, and go, because you're fully informed as to what the options are. Now, that's a bit of an expensive way of doing it. That's the way that we did it. But the benefit of that is when you start the case, you have a clear view of where you're going to end. You know what you need when you get there. The first way of doing it, very often you end up at trial going, oh, crap, I forgot to bring X. And at that point in time, it's too late to do anything about it. In this case, what we've done, we front-end loaded the work. We did all of the research fully, completely on every point that we wanted to bring. And frankly, JSS did a wonderful job bringing up some points which we hadn't even thought about internally. And then we gathered all the evidence for that. And all of that work that we did for the injunction application is the same work that we did for the main application. So, I mean, all of the affidavits that we've assembled, all of the research that we've assembled is going to get reused in the main case. Understand, of course, we're going to add on some more evidence, and we're going to have to, you know, bring on more arguments, some of which were informed by this injunction application, and some of this is just because the main case included things that we weren't going to take for a test drive in the injunction application. In order to provide a full answer, did we have some leakage? Yes. The work that we did in preparing the motion record argument, just the argument portion, not the evidence, not the research, but just the argument aimed specifically at the three-part test, for example, that was spent on the injunction, and we're not recycling that. But everything else, literally everything else, gets recycled. So we've suffered very little leakage on this. And like I said, we have the benefit now of having taken it for a test drive. And we also forced the government to at least show us some of which what arguments they're going to bring and some of the evidence that they're going to bring. And, you know, the Murray Smith is a prime example. I mean, that was the best that they could come up with. The Murray's evidence was effectively dismantled by the counsel that cross-examined him on it. That was an interesting decision, the court on that, just touching on that, because that was the second application that we brought concurrently with our injunction application, was to deal with Murray Smith's evidence. We were not successful. Sorry, I have to be careful here. We did not actually ask for his evidence to be excluded. Right? We asked for a declaration that he was not an expert. The cross-examination of Murray Smith was so effective that, in fact, we wanted to keep his evidence in because it tended to help us in an awful lot of circumstances. So we wanted to keep that in. So it wasn't, we weren't trying to have it excluded. We were just trying to have him declared as not being an expert. The court did not accept that argument, did not reject him as an expert. And that was partially because the parts of his evidence that we were relying on actually tended to suggest that he did have at least some expertise. That didn't address the issue of the conflict of interest and whether or not he's singing from a song sheet that is pre-written given his career. But that is what it is. In the end, that didn't really matter to us because Murray Smith's evidence didn't matter at all in the outcome of the injunction application. So we got to take his evidence for a cross-examination and a test drive in front of a judge as to what the court is going to do with Murray Smith's evidence as an expert. So we've got that intelligence as well.
Good. Good. Now, what are the next steps with our case? Like sort of timelines? I know we don't know for sure because we don't control that kind of stuff, but what does that look like?
Well, we do have some input into it. We don't have the next case management conference has not been scheduled yet. So we don't know when we're going to start doing things next as far as exchanging documents with the other side. We have, we're already working on the next things that we're going to do. Just to remind the listeners, one of the things that's going on is the government has refused to give us their documents and their evidence that the cabinet relied upon in making the order in council, which of course we find to be quite egregious because that's the foundation for the decision that we're challenging. And, you know, when you go for a judicial review of a decision, that the question is, based upon what was before you, council, did you in fact make a reasonable decision? And they're saying, we made a decision, but we're not going to show you the documents that, or the evidence that we relied upon, which is really quite comical for a government that said we're going to do evidence-based legislation. So we have an application pending, not scheduled yet, but pending for determination as to whether or not the government's going to be forced to give us those documents. They're on the bit of a horns of a dilemma, I would submit, in that if they don't give us any evidence, we're going to ask the court to infer that there simply isn't any, which, to be honest, from my perspective, is probably the case. If they do give us the evidence, I expect we're going to have a good time picking it apart. So we'll see what the court does with that as well.
So we have an application for that. So in all of that to say, we're fighting these people tooth and nail.
Absolutely. There's absolutely nothing that we're not doing. Every opportunity to oppose them, we're opposing them. I should say we're not doing things that have no hope of success, but everything that has a reasonable chance of success, where we might get some benefit, is being done. Every single thing is being done. And remind the listeners as well, too, this is one thing we haven't reported on recently, which we're going to have to remedy, is we've got a whole bunch of ATIP requests out there, like thousands and thousands and thousands of them. One of the things that the government said was, yes, we'll get you that information, but it's going to take 8 years. So we'll get back to you with that after your case is over, of course. Now, we've sought our remedies with complaints on that as well. But I mean, that tells you the nature of what the opposition that we're giving getting from the government. It's I'll just slow down here to make sure that I say this properly. They're not providing the evidence that they are normally obligated to provide under the legislation that governs their operations.
Awesome. Very, very carefully put. So I can only imagine the correspondence when they're like, oh, it's going to be 8 years. Cheers. That's probably what they said at the very end. I guess that's where we're at now. If you had to make a guess, do you like the main case, or do you think it's 6 months, a year, 2 years from now? What do you think?
The main case should be heard in federal court in the fall. I would say October, November would be reasonable. Now, people are going to say, well, hey, wait a minute, that's pressing seriously up on the deadline for the amnesty. And that's correct. And there's not really much we can do about that. After that, presuming the loser is going to appeal, and I'm confident that if that was us, we would. Then we're into the Federal Court of Appeal. And then after that, we're into the Supreme Court of Canada. Appeals do tend to move a little faster than the underlying case where the evidence is being prepared, because appeals are literally just a review of the record to see whether or not there's been an error of law that calls for a reversal. Nobody's weighing the evidence, and the evidence isn't being... we don't need to stop to assemble it or anything like that. It's just, here's the record that was before the federal court. Did they make a mistake? That goes to the Court of Appeal and then the Supreme Court of Canada. So that should move a little faster. That said, there's a reasonable chance that we're going to be on the other side of the amnesty period before this is over. And that creates some concern. One of the things that is of some interest, or has been of interest to date, is that it has appeared unlikely that even the government has been able to do something about that in order for them to be ready to hit the amnesty deadline. Now, that being said, we are expecting some new legislation next week on this file. What that looks like, we don't know, but everybody's read about it in the newspapers and in the Facebook groups and the chat groups about pending information about buyback in combination with grandfathering. So next week is going to be interesting. We're looking for that to come out on Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah. Well, awesome. Well, I appreciate the update. I'm sure everybody that's watching appreciates it. It's it's a lot better than me trying to figure out what the update is. I'm glad that you came on and we really appreciate it.
Well, I'm happy to do it, Rod, and happy to do it from time to time. If the listeners of the CCFR or if our members have any questions, I'm all over it. Send them on over.
Awesome. Thanks again, Mike.
Okay. Thanks, Rod.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for episode 85 of the CCFR Radio Podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. The podcast has jumped as far as how many people are watching and stuff. Don't forget to share. Really appreciate you coming by and spending that time with us. Hopefully you enjoyed hearing Mike provide an update. I certainly do. I hate having to take his information and from a secondhand perspective and then give it to you because I'm not a lawyer and I could never explain it the way Mike did. So thanks very much to Mike for coming on. We really appreciate that. And thanks for Tracy. Thanks to Tracy for coming on. We appreciate the update there and the conversation. There's a lot of fight ahead of us. There's legislation coming as we said on Tuesday. We're going to try to do a podcast Tuesday night. And get that up. And Mike is going to endeavor to get a hold of the legislation. If he has enough time, get a hold of the legislation itself and do a quick analysis of it. I'm hoping to have him on the podcast for Tuesday night. And I've talked to Wilson. I said, make sure you're available and see if we can get an update for gun owners out by then. Anyway, if you want to support the CCFR and all the work that we're doing, we would greatly appreciate you doing that. You can become a member at firearmrights.ca. You can give us a monthly gift, a recurring donation. That's great. Or donate there at firearmrights.ca. Either one, we really appreciate the help. Take care and we'll see you next time.
This is another episode of the CCFR Radio Podcast. Remember, if you don't stand up for your own ability to own and use firearms, who will? Join the CCFR or donate right now at www.firearmrights.ca.